From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A catastrophic explosion rocked the North Korean town of Rungchon Thursday. The first reports out of South Korea said the accident had claimed 3,000 lives. The reports had to come from South Korea because, as of Friday morning, the North Koreans had yet to acknowledge the incident at all. By Friday afternoon, according to diplomatic sources, the death toll stood in the hundreds, with many more seriously injured, but even those numbers are in doubt. 48 hours after the explosion, state television in North Korea still had not reported the disaster, concentrating instead on the visit by the country's leader, Kim Jong-il, to China. This program has often documented the difficulty of conducting journalism in a repressive society. In a closed society, it is next to impossible. Rebecca MacKinnon spent years attempting the impossible. She's now a fellow at Harvard's Joan Shorenstein Center on Press, Politics, and Public Policy, and she joins me now. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you very much.
After this explosion, the North Korean government not only did not acknowledge that it had taken place, but shut down international phone service, closed the border to China, which is only 12 miles away from the accident scene, and took other fairly typical measures for that society to suppress the news. You've been a reporter covering North Korea. How do you go about trying to find out what's going on and then getting information out of that extremely closed society?
Well, it's very tough because no Western news agencies or news organizations have bureaus in North Korea. Since really 2002, the North Koreans haven't been allowing American journalists in there at all. So if your news organization has an office in Beijing, you're calling people on the border who might have relatives on the other side who might know something about what's going on, or you might be relying on the South Korean press reports and South Korean journalists, and being ethnic Korean, they have a bit more access to information over on the other side because they employ North Korean defectors and so forth. But when you do get this information, it's almost impossible to confirm definitively with anybody inside North Korea. So it's extremely frustrating that the bulk of reporting about North Korea is all secondhand.
You mentioned the cultivation of defectors from the north to the south. I gather that's a sort of cottage industry within the media in South Korea.
It is to a certain extent, definitely. All the major newspapers in South Korea employ people who had originally been from North Korea because they're as close to an expert that anybody can get to, since they're not able to go across the border and have a frank interview with anybody directly.
Is there any way to know whether reporting that has taken place in the past about North Korea through this method is even accurate, to figure out whether the exercise of this kind of whisper down the lane is really serving the public?
That's a really good question. For instance, when it came to the famine in North Korea in the mid-90s, there is still tremendous dispute about how many people actually starved to death during that time. The numbers go from several million all the way down to a few thousand, depending on who you ask. Also, a lot of people in South Korea have been questioning reports in the U.S. media that are coming from CIA sources about the state of North Korea's nuclear weapons program. And they say, well, you know, the CIA leaked something to the New York Times and the New York Times reported it, but we can't confirm it independently. So therefore, why is everybody assuming it's true? You hear that a lot in South Korea. And defectors coming out of North Korea with stories about horrible human rights abuse. And while it's well documented that North Korea has an extremely serious human rights problem, there are people who question, well, where did that person get the information and can you prove it? And it becomes very hard to prove specific things that went on in North Korea.
People who do all the big thinking about regimes like the Kim Jong-il regime in North Korea often mention how external events can sometimes cause an opening that the ordinary course of politics cannot. Is there a chance that this devastating accident could open some channels of communication that hitherto had not existed?
Well, that is definitely a hope, and this is a real test to see to what extent North Korea values control of information versus helping its own citizens. And if controlling information and controlling access to their country is so important that it takes precedence over saving the lives of potentially hundreds of people, that definitely says something about the regime. Or if the regime decides that it is willing to accept the help, it is willing to risk having foreigners see things that maybe are not entirely positive about North Korea in order to help people there, then that would say that they might be more serious about opening up their country so that their people can be helped and pulled out of poverty as well.
Well, Rebecca, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Rebecca MacKinnon spent years attempting the impossible for CNN. She's now a fellow at Harvard's Joan Shorenstein Center on Press, Politics, and Public Policy. USA Today editor Karen Jurgensen and managing editor for News Hal Ritter were forced out of their jobs this week. Executive editor Brian Gallagher also announced he will leave his position after a new top editor takes over. Heads are rolling in the wake of a blistering report by an independent panel citing institutional weaknesses at the nation's top circulation daily, weaknesses which, the panel found, enabled foreign correspondent Jack Kelly to plagiarize and fabricate stories over more than a decade, despite the suspicions of colleagues and sources. Kelly's deceptions were first documented in January by a preliminary in-house investigation headed by Mark Memmott, one of Kelly's former editors, now reporter at USA Today. Like everyone else I've just named, Memmott is someone I've known since I worked at that paper 20 years ago. Mark, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Now, as the person who headed up the in-house investigation that predated this report by the tribunal, and as one of Jack's editors for years, you've spent a lot of nights staring at the ceiling, wondering and worrying. Tell me about that.
You wonder and you worry about, what did I miss? Did someone tell me something that I should have acted on? Why didn't I read those stories more closely? When you look at his work now, you know, if you read several years' worth of stories, you begin to see that, wow, they were fantastic. And, yeah, I'm kicking myself. There's lots of other editors here who are kicking themselves. I'm sure there are editors who were here in the early days and are now on to other things who are kicking themselves. We failed.
The report referred to your investigation several times and in a sort of dismissive way, saying that it was flawed from the outset because it was looking for evidence to disprove allegations against Jack Kelly as opposed to prove them. How stinging was that rebuke?
It was a shot, and it was wrong. We did not begin to try to disprove anything. At least I didn't. We did begin with a presumption of innocence.
And indeed, whatever your frame of mind, that investigation did unstop the hole in the dike. When you discovered that Jack had conspired with former sources and legmen to cover up his misdeeds, that allowed all the other lies and deceptions to gush out, no?
Yes, we were in a preliminary stage, but we lifted up the rock and found a pretty big crawler underneath.
Now, Mark, as you know, worked at USA Today for the first 3 years of that publication. I have my own little horror stories from the earliest days. I had one experience reporting on a Russian defector showing up at National Airport in Washington and about her first chaotic moments in the United States. But my lead on that story was rejected because it didn't conform with the executive editor's premise of huddled masses greeted with the welcoming arms in the land of milk and honey. Were the seeds of the Jack Kelly situation planted in the very concept of USA Today and its founding devotion to form over substance?
Oh, I think that there's probably a lot of truth to the fact that the seeds of the Jack Kelly tragedy go right back to the founding of the paper. I don't know if your specific kind of example is quite what produced Jack. My opinion would be more that Jack was a young guy when this paper began. It was too often acceptable practice to take things from the wires and rewrite them, to do clip jobs from other newspapers and perhaps not fully credit them. And as the newspaper grew up and stopped doing those sort of things, Jack apparently didn't.
Well, on a related subject, Al Newharth, the former chairman of Gannett, which owns USA Today, and the visionary who founded USA Today, took the newspaper to task in his own column in USA Today and said, "I told you so, I told you so. If you quote unnamed sources, it is a path that will lead to hell."
Obviously, unnamed sources are a huge issue in journalism and always have been. On the one hand, Watergate wouldn't have been revealed without them. On the other, in all publications, not just ours, source rules are loosely enforced, I would argue, and probably need to be more tightly enforced. However, that doesn't explain Jack just completely making things up. That's not an anonymous source issue. That's a fabrication issue. And the anonymous source rules would not have caught that at all.
Which leads back to the conclusion that, notwithstanding what the report has to say in identifying institutional problems at USA Today that created the environment for this to take place, that the Jack Kelly tragedy is the Jack Kelly tragedy, that this is a flawed human being who lied and betrayed his newspaper and his colleagues and his closest friends. Tell me, as someone who worked with this guy for 2 decades, what it's like to deal with that fact.
You thought you knew somebody, you thought you trusted them, you never would have imagined he could do this sort of thing. And it frankly makes you wonder, when you're reading other newspapers and magazines, should I trust this? And that's pretty sad. And I don't know when we'll get over it here.
Okay. Mark, thanks an awful lot.
Thank you, Bob.
Former Deputy Managing Editor Mark Memmott is a reporter at USA Today.
Next up, America's oldest, coolest new water cooler show, 60 Minutes, and a prosecutor and a pornographer consider obscenity.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this year, the Justice Department hired a lawyer named Bruce Taylor to a top position in its obscenity division. A hero in the anti-porn community, he's prosecuted hundreds of obscenity cases, including one at the Supreme Court against Larry Flint. If it sounds like a bit of a throwback, well, maybe it is. After a decade in which federal obscenity cases dwindled to single digits, the feds are again setting their sights on smut. President Bush's 2005 budget proposes $4 million in new funds for obscenity prosecutions, and the Justice Department claims that it's racked up 25 convictions in the past 2 years. Among the cases still pending is one against Extreme Associates, producers of such titles as Cornhole Armageddon and Depravity in Deutschland. The company is based in North Hollywood, but its movies are available nationwide on the net, and so it's been indicted in Pittsburgh, where community standards are somewhat more rigid. Extreme Associates is run by Rob Zicari, a.k.a. Rob Black, who joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Some communities will be more conservative than others, and prosecutors certainly will try to exploit that to their advantage, but even if you were prosecuted in your own backyard, do you think your defense could hold up?
Oh, definitely. And I think our defense will hold up in Pittsburgh. You know, this is the year 2004, and I have confidence that a jury will say, listen, there's a difference between watching entertainment and feeling, hey, that's not my, you know, cup of tea. I could do without seeing that for the next 30 years of my life. And saying, you know what, the person who made that should go to prison. We have 450 movies in our library. Maybe 10 of them are considered edgy. And they're no more edgy than horror movies that are out there today, or your Kill Bill, or even your Passion of Christ. You know, just like you see on Cinemax with the story of Ted Bundy or someone, and they show simulated sex, ours shows the sex. But that's the only difference.
What's the name of the one where Jesus comes down from the cross and rapes an angel?
That's Ask Clowns.
Uh-huh.
That's Ask Clowns 3, which had Bin Laden raping a reporter who were depicted as Ashley Banfield from CNN. And the funny thing is, we weren't indicted on that movie. We got indicted on three of them, which is Forced Entry, Extreme Teen, and Cocktails. And Extreme Teen is a series based off of older men with younger girls. We're not talking about children. You know, we're talking about that fantasy that Hollywood plays out every single day.
Do you think there is such a thing as obscene? How would you define it?
Something that's obscene is up to you. You know, I guess you could say, well, bestiality would be obscene and child pornography been obscene. Yeah, of course they're obscene, but they're illegal. And the illegalness of it takes precedent over something being obscene.
Right.
So if you take those things out of the realm, what's obscene? Well, you know what I find obscene? I find obscene watching these faith preachers, you know, show that they're healing crippled people. I find that obscene, bilking people out of money because they're, you know, depicting that they're healers.
Rob, why make a point of being extreme, though? Aren't you just inviting a lawsuit?
You know, that's a question of why does Miramax base their company on making edgy films? Why does Disney make family movies? You know, we built our company in a competitive market of the adult business that produces 10,000 new releases a year. The business is saturated. And we made our niche of being kind of extreme, being that Miramax, being that studio that, you know, maybe every couple of years is going to do something that raises the bar in the business where people go, hey.
Wait a minute. You're not really likening yourself to Miramax, though, are you?
We are making movies. Nothing more, nothing less. And we should be held in the same light as a real movie studio.
What about the current crackdown? Why do you think they're going after you? In the scheme of things, Extreme Associates is a pretty small player.
We are a smaller player, without a shadow of a doubt. But we are mainstream in the business, so to speak. We get nominated for awards and stuff. And if you go after somebody smaller, the first thing they're going to say is, well, why aren't you going after them? Look, they've said that their stuff is on the edge. They're crazy. They got big mouths. You should go after them. And if they could get a conviction here, then they just kind of move on down the line and start with everybody.
A lot of the anti-porn activists say that pornography is simply not a healthy way to learn about sex and love. And that, in the words of Morality and Media's Robert Peters, sex is linked to something greater than masturbating to depictions of other people having sex. Now, you grew up literally surrounded by porn. Your father was in the porn business. It surrounded you as you grew. How do you respond to this objection to porn, that it should be limited because it constitutes a negative influence on society as a whole? It's almost a public health argument.
Well, the only response to that is, who's the person to say they're going to be the deciding factor of what is not good for society? And where does it stop? Because I could probably list you 15 different things that also could probably contribute to not a good society, anywhere from the tobacco industry to alcohol sales to drug companies. I mean, it's ludicrous.
You produce 2 movies a week?
Since all the problems in paying lawyers and stuff, we've slowed considerably down just because we don't have the funds to produce like we did.
And what are you working on this week?
Nothing. Next week we're going to start working on a movie called Oral Hygiene 2. It's a love story.
Rob, thank you very much.
No, thank you very much.
Rob Zicari is founder and CEO of Extreme Associates. If and when his case finally goes to court, a jury of Zicari's peers, that is his Pennsylvania peers, will be asked to watch the 3 movies in question. And then, says Mary Beth Buchanan, the federal prosecutor handling Zicari's case, they will be asked to decide whether the films will meet the 3-part definition of obscene established in the 1973 case Miller versus California.
The first part is that the average person applying contemporary community standards would find that the material taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest. And prurient means unhealthy and degrading interest in sex. Second, that the average person applying those same contemporary community standards would find that the material depicts sexual conduct in a patently offensive manner. And last, that a reasonable person viewing the material, again, as a whole, would find that the material lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value.
And that's why the government decided to go after this company?
Extreme Associates is involved in producing hundreds of videotapes, and many of these videotapes, we believe, meet the federal obscenity definition. They had absolutely no plans to try to comply with the law. In fact, it was their intention to produce the most disgusting material. So they're really not a very sympathetic defendant.
We were talking to Rob Zakari about the issue of community standards, and here's what he told us.
You know, those community laws that were based back in the early 70s, the main goal was for the community to decide, hey, we don't want this strip club or adult bookstore right next to our child's school. There was no videotapes. There was no internet. There was no DVDs. They did not envision this form of media. So then those community standards, they're not applicable. You know, sitting in your home and privately ordering a tape from me in the mail, me sending it to your house in a brown paper bag, doesn't affect the community.
Well, I strongly disagree. Extreme Associates is subject to the laws of every jurisdiction throughout the country where they choose to sell their product. You take an average person who knows their community, and they have to determine as an average person whether their community would find the material obscene. It doesn't mean that the community had to see it or the community is about to see it, but just whether the community would find it obscene.
So does that mean that the spectrum basically narrows down to what the average person would find offensive?
That's correct.
If Zakari and Romano are convicted, they could face up to 50 years in prison. And Zakari likes to point out that that's more than double the sentence for someone who actually commits a rape in Pittsburgh. He's just depicting rape in his movies.
The Zakaris face a sentence of up to 50 years in prison because they've been charged with 10 counts of violating federal law. So they could be sentenced for up to 5 years for each charge. Certainly someone who is convicted of rape 10 times would face a much longer sentence than the Zakaris face.
Now, the current wave of prosecutions represents a turnaround from the Clinton era, where obscenity was rarely prosecuted at the federal level. What do you think has been the effect of roughly a decade of lax enforcement?
I think that the reason that we are seeing such an expansion of the type of material that is available today is because there was a total lack of enforcement of the federal obscenity laws in the 1990s. Had we been enforcing the law during this time period, I don't think that we would be seeing the type of material that's available today.
Do you think it's really because of the prosecution environment, or is it simply that the internet has made porn more available and easier to disseminate and easier to view in the privacy of your home?
You know, it's really not that different from speeding. If you don't think that law enforcement is going to stop you, you're going to continue to push the limit.
So what's the next step for justice? Will you eventually be going after bigger adult movie makers or the hotel chains that make a fortune off of porn delivered to people's rooms, the cable companies?
We have to look at every piece of material on a case-by-case basis. And we are looking at those producers who are producing the worst material and the producers who are providing this material on a large-scale basis. So it's really going to depend upon the content of the material.
And in every case, you'll be trying to determine whether this material is patently offensive to the average viewer.
That's correct.
Mary Beth Buchanan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary Beth Buchanan is U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania. She joined us from the studios of WDUQ in Pittsburgh.
First, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, then former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark, and last week, The Washington Post's Bob Woodward. If you've written a book that shakes up the Washington establishment, 60 Minutes, at least lately, is the place to be.
Beyond not asking his father about going to war, Woodward was startled to learn the president did not ask key cabinet members either.
The president, in making the decision to go to war, did not ask his Secretary of Defense for an overall recommendation, did not ask his Secretary of State, Colin Powell, for his recommendation.
This week, Daily Show host Jon Stewart called the program the premier venue for taking a steamer on the Bush administration. What is it with this show? After four decades, creator Don Hewitt will step down at the end of this season, but Hewitt's winning formula will stay firmly in place. Joining us now is Richard Campbell, author of 60 Minutes in the News, a mythology for Middle America, which anatomized the secret of the show's success. Richard, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Sketch for me, please, the media climate into which 60 Minutes emerged 35 years ago.
That was 1968, and I think that 60 Minutes, for me, was part of a movement that we usually associate with print and written material, the new journalism or the literary journalism. This was the adaptation of fictional storytelling devices to journalism. And it's probably better known in the work of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood or Tom Wolfe's Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. But 60 Minutes was a visual version of that, a TV version of that. And what Don Hewitt, the creator of 60 Minutes, and still its guiding light, tried to do was figure out a way for reporters to be stars in their stories. And probably more than anyone else, foregrounded the use of narrative structure in creating television journalism program that's still probably the model today for all the shows.
Can you tell me how he applied the principles of storytelling to the news?
Well, I think the dominant story form on 60 Minutes is the detective story. And I think the idea is the championing of a heroic individual, usually the detective, who figures out everything and at the end of the story presents the denouement or the climax. And in the 60 Minutes model, the reporters often behave as detectives, even down to a tradition of wearing trench coats. And this is a powerful narrative in our culture, particularly because of the celebration of individualism and the notion of the individual reporter or detective confronting evil and righting wrongs.
Okay, familiar narrative techniques, but for whatever reason, 60 Minutes seems to be in a particularly fertile period. Is there a difference between how 60 Minutes operates in a time of political conflict as opposed to just ordinary times?
I wouldn't say it's flourishing. I mean, its audience is half of what it used to be. It's still the biggest game in journalism. I mean, any single episode of 60 Minutes attracts a bigger journalism audience than any other journalism outlet in the United States. Still today, we're talking between 15 and 20 million people. That many people don't read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal in a day, and certainly that many people aren't watching Peter Jennings in the evening or Tom Brokaw. I think it made its reputation during the Watergate era, interviewing all of the key players in Watergate. I think it made Bill Clinton's career in 1992 when he and Hillary went on and kind of explained Jennifer Flowers away. And 60 Minutes kind of okayed him for the run.
There are certain 60 Minutes characteristics in the way the camera is deployed and the way edits are done. Can you describe some of them for us?
Villains and victims on 60 Minutes are usually shot in much tighter close-ups, often with the top of their head and the bottom of their chin cropped from the frame. And then there's a reaction shot from the reporters, and the reporters are usually shown with plenty of space over their heads. It's usually a medium shot or middle shot. And they look much more in control of space than the interview subjects on the show. And that's a technique that they've used since the beginning.
And it has a certain sort of demonizing quality as well, doesn't it?
I'm thinking of
Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. Those tight close-ups are positively eerie. So is it fair to do that? Isn't it a sort of visual editorializing?
60 Minutes has never claimed to be some kind of objective piece of journalism. They have a story to tell. And whenever you tell a story, you're going to have villains and victims. And what 60 Minutes does in its narrative, it celebrates the individual and usually does demonize institutions, bureaucracies, there have been many times, particularly in the old days, where the Pentagon during the Reagan administration wouldn't talk to 60 Minutes, and they'd simply take an aerial photo of the Pentagon, and that's how it was represented. Well, representing an institution by an aerial photo of a building is a very impersonal way to treat an institution, but it kind of fits the 60 Minutes formula. And I would argue this is probably a major problem with journalism in general. They have great ways to tell stories about individuals, but they don't have narratives to tell stories about how institutions work or don't work. Journalism lacks those kinds of narratives, and I think it hurts us as a culture.
Well, Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Richard Campbell is the former director of the Journalism School at Middle Tennessee State University. He's on his way to a similar job at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio.
Coming up, why the White House press is the last to know, also an epistolary compulsive, and what author Helen Fielding wrought.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If you want to get the latest on President Bush's schedule, you might find that you're better off scanning the pages of the foreign press than consulting the White House press corps. Guatemalan President Oscar Berger was 2 weeks ahead of the White House in announcing his upcoming visit to Washington. It was the Palestinian Authority and not the Bush administration that first tipped the media off about then-Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas's July visit to the White House. Washington Post scribe Dana Milbank says that reporters learned long ago that the best source on presidential events is often found anywhere but the White House.
Olivier Knox, who covers the White House for AFP, did a little takeoff on a common White House phrase. They like to say, when we have something to announce, we'll announce it. But Olivier said a better phrase would be, when we have something to announce, a foreign government will announce it. So this has happened in Ireland with the president's upcoming visit to Shannon. It happened at the president's visit to Tokyo last fall. This happens on domestic trips as well. We find them out more likely through local newspapers, hearing it from Republican officials rather than the White House. For example, the president's recent trip to Des Moines, Iowa, came to us via the Des Moines Register. His trip this week to Pittsburgh first surfaced in a column by Bob Novak.
But what is it about scheduling that the White House really doesn't want guys like you to know? And the same thing happened again when British Prime Minister Tony Blair visited last week. The American press corps heard about it from British officials.
Obviously, there are times when the White House does not want to broadcast the president's schedule too much in advance. They don't want to give bad guys a chance to target him. In other cases, for example, I pointed out that a Little League team from Orlando was coming to the White House, and the White House officials were refusing to confirm this. And it's hard to imagine, even if they were using aluminum bats, that this would have been a major threat to the White House. So it's become a bit of a running joke. In fact, Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, he rushed into the morning briefing, which he did aboard Air Force One, to announce when the visit of Jordan's King Abdullah had been rescheduled for. It had been canceled this week. And he said he did that quickly so that the Jordanians could not beat him to it.
If the Bush administration goes out of its way not to confirm, even when confronted with visits by foreign dignitaries, visits by our ambassadors to other nations, the fact that we can't even learn that kind of thing from the White House, what does that suggest to you?
Well, it's part of the ethos. It's symbolic. The administration, any administration, starts with a monopoly of information. They have all the power that way. This administration has done much better than others at hoarding that power. And what they have found in small areas, like whether the president's trip to Des Moines gets announced by the Des Moines Register, or whether accounts of internal meetings in the White House get written about in books by Paul O'Neill and his fellow writer, or by Dick Clark, the information ultimately gets out anyway. The lesson I think that it would be nice for the Bush White House to glean from this is that it might as well be more forthcoming with information in the first place. There's obviously a good public service case to be made for having information sooner rather than later.
Dana, thanks very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Dana Milbank covers the White House for The Washington Post.
In the letters section of the current Harper's Magazine, one reader chastises an editorial by Harper's editor Lewis Lapham for, quote, failing to confront the extent of evil arising from Islamic fundamentalism dating back to the 1948 war to exterminate Israel. It's signed by one Nelson Marins of Silver Spring, Maryland. Close readers of magazines and newspapers might recognize the name. It's not the first time a missive from Mr. Marins has been published. In fact, it's the 31st time this year. In an epistolary career stretching back to his retirement 17 years ago, Nelson Marins has successfully placed 966 letters in the pages of American newspapers and magazines. The anti-Israel bias that he often sees in Middle East coverage has inspired a lot of them, but in the past year, editors have printed his strong opinions on just about everything. Nelson, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
In the past year, you have written letters addressing the bombing of Dresden, Germany,
yes,
during the end of World War II, the superiority of marble as a sculpting material, Pete Rose, stock options, and, of course, circumcision. And wedding cakes, Nelson, you've written. Why don't you just read for me, please, your June 18th letter to the New York Times on the subject of wedding cakes.
All right. I'll have to see if I can find it. While a delicious cake would cap off any wedding, we should be practical as to what is really required. With the overwhelming array of hors d'oeuvres and then a sumptuous meal accompanied by drinks, the average wedding guest is too food besotted to appreciate anything other than the cake's appearance. The real function of most wedding cakes is to supply a piece of an elaborate box to be taken home as a souvenir. For the bride and groom, a few pieces to be frozen and eaten on wedding anniversaries are required. Certainly a delicious wedding cake is desirable, but it is usually an indulgence, not for the guests, but for the wedding party.
All right. What prompted this outburst about the function of wedding cakes? And by the way, who died and made you arbiter of wedding cake etiquette?
What happened was they were describing these elaborate wedding cakes that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And I was saying to myself, what a waste. It's just overindulgence. I'm not bothered if people disagree, and I'm not bothered if people consider that I'm acting as an arbiter. I know I'm not. Everybody has a certain amount of knowledge about a subject, and I think that they should express that knowledge. And I always encourage my friends to write, because I feel that writing is a lost art for many people, and I see no reason why individuals should restrict themselves to talking about subjects without writing about the subject.
How passionate do you need to be on a given subject before you are moved to write? I'm going to just assume that you get very, very irate over your perception of the mischaracterization of the Palestinians vis-a-vis the Israelis. Do you get just as outraged over wedding cakes?
No, of course not. This is sort of a fun type of letter. I wrote to the Wall Street Journal when they said that Vitalis 7 might go out of business, not the company, but the actual hair tonic. And I said, well, you know, these old geezers still need something like that to keep their hair down. What hair I have left, unfortunately. Sometimes I write because I feel it's a humorous statement, which sometimes is not appreciated.
I know this is going to sound like a snotty question. I promise you I don't mean for it to be. But why do you do this?
Why do I do it?
Mm-hmm.
Simply because I feel that once I do it and I have some antagonism or trauma attached to reading what I see, it acts as a purge. It's completely off my mind after that. I feel that I've done everything I can, and, you know, I'll relax.
What about the 779 times in 2003 where the tree fell in the forest and there was no newspaper willing to publish it?
I'll be honest, it only takes me 15 minutes to write a letter. I consider that if I have 779 letters written, that's approximately 200 hours of wasted time. As a retired individual, I have a lot more than 200 hours of wasted time.
Are there any papers that, for all your efforts over the years, you just haven't been able to crack?
Well, there's a magazine that I've never been able to crack, and I'm sure I'll never be able to crack it in my lifetime, and that's The Economist. I heard that they only publish one letter from a person per lifetime, but I haven't had my quota.
Well, Nelson Marins, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the time.
And Nelson and everybody, if you have a question or a comment, you can reach us at onthemedia@wnyc.org.
First, there was literature, and that begat, in the waning years of the last century, chick lit, which in turn spawned lady lit and bridal lit and mom lit and Latina lit and black chick lit and Asian chick lit and Christian chick lit and inevitably, making a big splash this spring and summer, lad lit. But what sparked this literary mitosis? Or, put another way, from whose womb sprang all these lits?
It all began on New Year's Day in my 32nd year of being single. Once again, I found myself on my own and going to my mother's annual turkey curry buffet. Every year she tries to fix me up with some bushy-haired, middle-aged boar, and I feared this year would be no exception.
It was the literary imagination of Helen Fielding that gave birth to Bridget Jones' Diary, a blockbuster novel that was made into a blockbuster movie. Fielding is widely regarded as the godmother of chick lit, and if literary subgenres were children, Bridget Jones would be the world's most fecund single mom.
You know, this started in the mid-1990s with Bridget Jones' Diary.
I loved Bridget Jones' Diary.
The Bridget Jones books are a lot of fun from a writerly perspective.
I think Helen Fielding's a great writer, the one who did Bridget Jones' Diary.
And Bridget Jones' Diary, I mean, it's sort of hard to improve on.
I've actually never even read Bridget Jones' Diary.
Jennifer Weiners is one of the many literary voices you just heard, you'll hear from them all again, who pay deference to Fielding. Weiners' novel, Good in Bed, was about an overweight woman who undergoes some humiliation, faces and conquers her fears, and achieves success. Quintessential chick lit, it was an international bestseller.
I would say that chick lit is any novel where you have a smart, spunky, benighted female heroine who is anywhere between maybe 22 and 40-ish, who will, in the course of the novel, have awful things happen to her, but will persevere, usually with her cadre of eccentric friends, her semi-dysfunctional family, and perhaps a pet.
Now, does she have to be spunky, or could she be feisty?
She has to be one or the other. I mean, she can't be mopey. She can't be introspective. She can be quirky.
And, you know, she usually works in publishing. That's a big sort of trope. And it's usually a lot of sort of complaints about crappy bosses and looking for Mr. Right. And there's a lot of kind of Prada bags and Jimmy Choo shoes.
Angela Rasdin wrote about contemporary chick lit in the latest issue of Utney magazine. She observes that when it's chick lit, you really can tell a book by its cover.
They are usually pastel colored, kind of Easter egg shades. They usually have kind of retro icons of martini glasses or handbags or pumps on them. And, you know, this isn't big canvas storytelling. It's kind of the mundane, everyday, obsessive and superficial details of women's lives. And I find that comforting to read.
Now the book world is comforting women in the form of ever closer approximations of themselves. Wait long enough, and even if you're a half-Black, quarter-Asian, quarter-Latino, 40-ish office manager based in Milwaukee, there'll be a genre just for you. And it'll have the quirky friends you don't have time for, the pet your landlord won't allow, and the guy you never got to meet. I threw in 40-ish because as the authors of chick lit age, so do the obsessions of their characters. For instance, Weiner's next book, due out in September, is about the perils of being a mom. Angela Rasdin of Utney Magazine.
As in with any genre, whether it's chick lit or horror or mystery, you have the good, bad, and the really bad.
Let's pause for a moment and consider the bad. Last Sunday's New York Times Book Review offered this exuberant pan of a new bit of chick lit, Bergdorf Blondes by Plum Sykes. Reviewer Corey Sika says the book was so bad it should inspire readers to rise up and rip each other limbless. He went on,
"In all seriousness, we must build a tiny apocalypse-proof time capsule. If we can resist the temptation to burn Plum Sykes' book, we can smuggle it into the future. Perhaps the next breed of humanoids can learn from the holocaust of culture and commerce that destroyed our icky civilization."
So like any lit, chick lit can be prey to bad writing. But good or bad, certain feminists believe that chick lit is almost always sending the wrong message about success.
What this particular genre tells us is that we haven't yet reached a point with feminist change where women can set the terms by which they are defined. These characters are examining what they're taught to examine in order to be perfect by other people's standards.
Hannah Blank writes criticism, novels, and lesbian erotica. She says the heroines of chick lit all find their way to fulfillment along the same narrow path: a well-paying job, a devoted boyfriend.
You're not shown women who are trying to rebel against what they're given in terms of what's supposed to make a good life for a woman or what's supposed to make a woman successful.
And I just think that's too much of a burden for light entertainment reading to bear.
Angela Rasden.
We're in the midst of what some people call third wave feminism or lipstick feminism. Some people think it's a post-feminist age, but part of that is that, you know, we can have our trashy beach reads and our intellectual reads, and we can sort of be successful and feminist and still think about boys and lipstick and our weight. And it doesn't make us any less of a feminist. We don't have to be our best selves at all times.
But Hannah Blank sees a cultural playing field that is not yet level.
Until we have a guy lit that is a parallel to chick lit, the best we can do is to look at the action hero genre of novels that are aimed at men and say, okay, this is what men are given for their entertainment reading. They're given these idealized versions of what men are supposed to be like. And here's what women are given. Here's what's marketed to them.
But we do have a guy lit that is parallel to chick lit, that is at least partly directed at men. It's called Lad Lit, and publishers are hoping that both guys and gals will buy it. There's even a male Helen Fielding who's godfather to the genre. His name is Nick Hornby. His books High Fidelity and About a Boy have already played at a theater near you, and though his work has never sold as well as Fielding's, publishers are piling on the lad lit. Hornby looms so large that first-time novelist Kyle Smith pays him homage in his new book, Love Monkey, published by William Morrow. Read from that section.
Every girl I know has read his book, and they all want, or think they want, to meet a guy like the guy in the book. More specifically, they want to meet the guy who wrote the book. What must a party be like for that guy? He must get home from the pub and empty his jacket pockets and go, "Whose phone number is this? And why is it written on a pair of panties?" He wrote the world's longest personal ad and got paid for it.
In Love Monkey, the Bridget Jones character is named Tom Farrell. And yes, he works in publishing, at a tabloid modeled after the New York Post, where Smith once worked.
I think the men will identify with the character because I think a lot of guys have been in the same situation that the guy in Love Monkey is in. Like, they're trying to be smooth and suave and trying to woo a woman. And I think for women, the advantage is that they'll sort of see inside the male mind.
That is, if they want to. The release of Love Monkey was covered everywhere from Time magazine to Men's Health to scores of newspapers, but it sold fewer than 2,000 copies in its first 6 weeks, according to Nielsen BookScan. According to Publishers Weekly, Lad Lit has already hit the skids. Chicks didn't buy it, lads didn't buy it.
I can imagine. You know, men are just now getting trained to use moisturizer and wear clothes without pleats.
Writer and reviewer Corey Sika.
So they now must be taught by the commerce powers that be that they're supposed to read Lad Lit.
Thus, in the face of all evidence to the contrary, People magazine declared this spring that chick lit is out and Lad Lit is in. To that end, Pocketbook is releasing 3 Lad Lit titles this summer. Maybe they'll sell better in hot weather. There's a kind of sweet revenge in all this. It's an old saw that men aren't interested in stories about women, though women will consume stories about men. That's probably still true when it comes to movies. But women buy the novels. They've always bought the novels. And for the moment, the buyers of chick lit, of every age, race, religion, and nationality, would much rather contemplate themselves. Or at least parts of themselves.
There have been stories published in a lot of the trade publications that legs on books, women's legs, work.
Craig Burke is publicity director of several Penguin imprints.
I don't know if that's true, but we've certainly put a lot of legs on covers. this year, for some reason, there are a lot of disembodied feet on books.
Here's looking at you, kid.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen, our engineer. We had help from Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.